Hello, I'm Kat Ellinger, an author, editor and critic, and this is Brunello Rondi's Il Demonio from 1963, a very underrated and rare example of an Italian folk horror film, which also is a very early proto-possession film as well. And one that's very, very interesting in the canon of the overall Italian gothics. But also because of the production team behind this, this was the first production credit for Luciano Martino, brother of director Sergio Martino, and Sergio also worked on this film. So it's the beginning of the Martino brothers, who became part of the backbone, really, of the Italian B industry throughout the late 60s and into the 70s. Rondi himself, even though he was a prized intellectual, he worked very, very closely with Federico Fellini as a screenwriter and collaborator over the course of some of Fellini's most outstanding and influential films. Rondi barely gets a mention in the whole sphere of Italian film, especially when it comes to his work as a director. In English language speaking scholarship, and the one exception to that is the work of Roberto Curti, who's been somewhat of a champion for Rondi in trying to argue for a reassessment of Rondi as a very fascinating and interesting filmmaker in his own right, especially in the book Mavericks of Italian Cinema, Eight Unorthodox Filmmakers, 1940s to 2000s, which was published in 2018. Curti writes about Il Demonio and argues that it can't really be called a horror film at all. And I'd agree with that statement to a certain extent. It has far more in common with something like Dreyer's Day of Wrath, for example, than it does the work of Mario Bava in that field, things like Black Sunday, for example. So you could argue, is this a horror film at all? But I think since the subject of folk horror has broadened, especially in the last several years, and especially in light of Kayla Genise's recent documentary, which is included in this Severin box set dedicated to folk horror and some of the more rarer folk horror, there is definitely room to include Il Demonio into that field, given the fact that it was based on the work of anthropologist Ernesto Di Martino, and we see that at the beginning of the film. It's highlighted that that is one of the main inspirations behind this. And Di Martino, and I'll be talking about the ritual magic he studied in southern Italy, wrote several books on the matter, this idea of paganism and Catholicism being joined as one in rural southern Italy. And a lot of the magic or ritual that is featured in this film comes directly out of the pages of Ernesto Di Martino's studies. The film does also have some connection to Gothic, and the Italians in the Gothic field never ever went the obvious route. They were drawing from a much wider range of influences than, say the British or American stuff, who are largely looking to the classics, especially the British classics, for inspiration. So it does have a connection to Gothic as well, but it's a bit of an outlier within the Gothic canon, and I'll look at that a little bit later on in this track. But what I want to do now to kick off is examine why this can classify as a folk horror. I think if Kayla's documentary shows anything, it's that folk horror, out of all the subgenre terms, is one of the most nebulous and most difficult to define. And almost every person in that documentary has a slightly different take or opinion on what qualifies as specifically folk horror. And the term has been around for a long old time, but the first time it was ever mentioned in conjunction with specifically genre film was when Piers Haggard, the director, applied it to his own film, Blood on Satan's Claw, in a 2004 interview with Fangoria magazine. And then following on from that, Mark Gatiss used the term again, and this is where it became somewhat popularised in his History of Horror documentary that was aired on the BBC here in the UK. And he applied it to three films specifically. The Piers Haggard film, Blood on Satan's Claw, Witchfinder General from Michael Reeves, and Robin Hardy's The Wicker Man. So those three films have become like the trifecta, the unholy trinity they're often described as, of definitive folk horrors. And for a few years after that, folk horror largely became connected to a very small subsection of specifically British horror films and then British television made around the same period, so late 60s, early 70s. But once that term became popularised, people started to look at what constitutes folk horror and started to find folk horror exists across the board within different cultures. This isn't a specifically British thing, and it's not something so limited to just that small portal in time and place. Although looking at those three films, you can see some of the, I guess, the defining aspects of folk horror. You can list them out, which helps with the definition. And in terms of those films, Il Demonio definitely has things in common with both Witchfinder General and The Wicker Man. So it does have a connection to those films. But people started to look at what is folk horror, and the definition started to widen. And what you find is in cultures very rich in folk history, cultures that have a strong background in paganism, for example, or wild rural landscapes, so places like Eastern Europe, you could easily qualify a lot of quote-unquote horror or horrific films from those places as being essentially folk horror. And this is what's happened with Il Demonio. What makes it interesting in the discussion of folk horror is it's a rare example of Italian folk horror. The Italian Gothics, much like those made in Britain and America, although they looked to a wider range of sources, did generally follow the same lines that, say, Hammer Horror were using, or Roger Corman in the US, in looking at those ideas of Gothic monstrosity, dualism, bringing up the classics, really. Although Mario Bava was much more eclectic in the sources that he used. So, for example, the inspiration behind Black Sunday was V. And V, in and of itself, kind of harbours certain aspects of folk horror because it has this strong connection to a belief in witchcraft. So before I start breaking this down as a folk horror, I'll just say, given how broad this definition is, you can find some agreement. So generally, folk horror needs to have either some sort of pagan belief or old folk elements, so something that comes from a much older tradition than Gothic literature, which really kicked off in the late 1700s and then flourished in the 1800s. Gothic through the Romantics was actually influenced by these folk elements, but through the writing, through this literary tradition, they became somewhat detached from them. They became obscured and hidden. So, for example, if you look at the vampire and you think of one of the leading lights in that, Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, which itself was inspired by Coleridge's Christabel. Now, that draws heavily from a much wider folk tradition that dates back, right back to the dark goddesses like Lilith and Lamia. So there are these strains there, but they got filtered out. So folk horror is generally anything that wears those folk influences on its sleeve and doesn't attempt to obscure them behind a formal classic literary form like Gothic. You also have the fact that folk horror exclusively takes place in rural locations. The superstitions surrounding those locations, or even in some cases, the land's ability to influence someone's psyche, influence their behaviour. They can be influenced by that landscape. And sometimes this influence, as it does in Il Demonio, can represent a conflict between old and new world values. So pre-industrialization and post-industrialization. And here we have a story that's set in southern Italy. We're not made aware of what time period this is set in, so it could really be any time or place. But this is a culture that is shrouded in superstition and belief, absolute unquestioning belief in the power of witchcraft as an evil force. And what Rondi is doing here is linking it to something that occurs in the real world. So he's giving it a very solid grounding in the folk rituals and practices that were still around in the 1950s when Ernesto Di Martino was doing his studies. This was being considered by cosmopolitan Romans, for example, in the post-war period as old-fashioned, but it was something that still remained in the sidelines in those more rural communities. So instantly the film gets a grounding in a rich heritage, a rich tradition. And sometimes folk horror can involve the supernatural elements of those folk stories, so the shapeshifters or the witches who actually have supernatural power. But then some of them, like the Wicker Man, like Witchfinder General, actually observe those customs and rituals as dangerous, is inherently dangerous because they are in part a delusion. And so what you get in Witchfinder General is the demonization of women as a witch, and this is certainly applicable to Il Demonio. And what you get in The Wicker Man is this idea of a community who come together bound by these pagan beliefs that will lead them to sacrifice. These beliefs become the linchpin for very deviant, even murderous behavior to be justified within an insular community. And there's certainly aspects of that in Rondi's film as well, in the way that Puri is treated and ultimately the way her fate is decided once she's outed as a witch. Ernesto Di Martino's studies on ritual magic in southern Italy are astounding. Magic, a Theory from the South, which was first published in 1959, seems to have been the main influence on this film, where Di Martino went out to southern Italy, especially Lucania, and interviewed people there and built up this study of the various rituals and superstitions that were bred in these communities. He starts off in his first chapter talking about binding, and this is something that is happening now with Puri. Now, in a neo-pagan environment, the concept of binding was really popularized by the 1996 pop culture hit, The Craft, where binding in a Wiccan tradition, and Wicca really was more of a contemporary religion or spiritual faith that was spearheaded by a guy called Gerald Gardner in England in the 1930s. And it became very, very popular in counterculture communities and remains very popular today. And The Craft uses a lot of Wiccan ritual, including this idea of binding. And binding in that context is performing a spell where you bind somebody who you feel has put a curse or a hex on you or has a bad intention against you. You bind them so they are unable to enact this hex on you. You bind them from causing you harm. Binding in DeMartino's Magicka Theory from the South is a very different concept. He starts out in saying the fundamental theme of low ceremonial magic in Lucania is binding. This term indicates a psychic condition of impediment or inhibition, and at the same time a sense of domination, a being acted upon by a force that is strong as it is mysterious, one that totally removes a person's autonomy as well as his capacity for decision-making and choice. And so according to this specific tradition, binding really refers to this process where somebody is possessed. DeMartino says the experience of domination can reach the point that an abnormal personality more or less completely invades behavior, a personality that is in contrast with the community's accepted norms. The subject will no longer simply be bound, but spiritato, someone possessed and in need of an exorcism. And this is exactly how Puri experiences what looks from the outside as a mental breakdown, some form of mental health episode that causes her to both hear voices and have these awful delusions. And the mass hysteria around her, this idea that she's a witch, the fact that everybody is in on this belief and thinks that she's possessed, she doesn't really stand a chance. Although weirdly, and I'll go into this a little bit later on, this superstition also becomes something of a source of power to her, even though ultimately it leads to her destruction. You can also link this to a kind of Calvinist Gothic in a way as well, which is derived from novels like Charles Brockden Brown's Wieland, which was first published in 1798 and is the first American Gothic novel, where you have a man in that who is obsessed with the notion that his family are infected with original sin and the only way to free them is to kill them, to free them from this sin. And that novel possibly had an influence on Stephen King for The Shining. You see it used much later on in the 70s for George A. Romero's Martin, where you have a mentally ill or mentally vulnerable and fragile young man who has been told his whole life he's a vampire, and various family members subscribe to that delusion as a reality. And the true horror in that, as in Il Demonio, is this idea that somebody cast out as evil, somebody who is as mentally fragile as Puri, as Martin, is then punished and thrown out by their families and put in real danger rather than given the compassion and safety and love that they need to recover. Puri's psychosis in this is derived from the fact that she's had recently had an affair with this guy called Antonio. He's cast her aside and now he's off to marry somebody else, and she just cannot cope with the rejection, made even more painful by the fact that this is a very patriarchal Catholic society that works on the notion of virginal young brides, etc., etc. And so Puri's transgression has already marked her out as somewhat stained as a woman, because she dared to give in to her passions, and we're led to believe she naively believed the things that Antonio told her. So Antonio's really the bad guy, but his reality and his position in marrying the new bride is protected by this patriarchal system. And it's Puri who is pushed out. It is Puri who is outcast and then punished because she fell in love with him. Now, her power in that situation is she believes that she can control the situation, that she can somehow win Antonio back through the use of witchcraft. And this is one of the things that was traditionally and has always been considered so dangerous about witchcraft. This idea of women daring to have power, daring to move away from the patriarchal Christian-based faiths to embrace something else, to embrace something where they feel they may have some power. As a result, they're demonized for that. And the witch-finding manual, the Malleus Maleficarum, which was written by a Catholic clergyman called Heinrich Kramer and then published in 1486 and became generally the blueprint for catching witches, was very much written in that vein. And the women that were seen as witches in that manual were women that largely had their own opinions and had fought for their own agency. Although not always, you could get cast out as a witch just for looking at somebody the wrong way or speaking out of turn. So traditionally, that Christian backdrop has severely persecuted women with pagan beliefs. And so Il Demonio really is about a woman who's persecuted, a woman who is desperate to try and get some control. And if we look to the DiMartino book for reference to the certain rituals that she uses, he says in chapter 2, Binding an Eros, a woman must make every effort to enchant a man. If the spell is not successful right away, she will have to repeat it for months and months, but always in odd numbers until her man gives in. Menstrual blood, vaginal fluid, hairs from armpits and the pubis, blood from the veins all have a greater power to bind and to attract, to pry a desired male away from a rival. Beside the usual potions were drops of menstrual blood in wine, coffee, broth, and other drinks. Other potions may be used that are duly consecrated. And we saw when she met Antonio on the road and she got him to drink that wine, that's obviously what was in there. It was laced with a menstrual fluid, and we all know how terrifying anything to do with menstrual fluid is. The fact that she made him drink it, or tricked him into drinking it, is incredible. And what's especially fascinating to me is somebody who has aligned more with neo-paganism, which has a distinct separation from the church, is how some of these more rural superstition or folk-based witchcraft beliefs have been enmeshed with Catholicism. And so we saw, in order to consecrate her little spell that she'd done on Antonio, she actually took it into the church during Mass to charge it. There's none of this hiding away in the woods around a cauldron. she brazenly brings it into the church. And this again comes from the DeMartino study, where he says, Colobraro, a powerful love potion, is made from the following recipe. The little finger of the right hand is tied and pricked, and 3 drops of blood are drawn. A lock of hair is cut from the armpits and the pubis. The hairs are mixed with the blood, and the mixture is dried in the oven. This yields a powder that is brought to church to be consecrated during Mass. And at the moment of the elevation, one murmurs the following: Blood of Christ, demon, tie me to this one. You must bind him so hard that he won't be able to forgive me. And so there is this weird fellowship within the church, this marrying of paganism, old world paganism, and Catholic beliefs, where paganism in this sphere, as a folk form of folk ritual, has also been tied firmly to the church. So it's up to the church to deal with it. But people also use the church to charge their spells, which seems really odd if you're used to seeing paganism as it's usually used in genre film, for example, like The Devil Rides Out or The Craft or Hammer's The Witches, or so many of these films that look at Satanists and pagans, the Wicker Man, that is this really separate force or secret societies. Here, this is very much part of the fabric of a community, and these spells will be in widespread cultural consciousness. People will know them or know of them. DeMartino really wanted to know why these things had endured even post-industrialization, and came to the conclusion that people living in these communities, largely farming communities, the things that they most feared, the life and death cycle, the weather, which could just wipe out a crop, the high mortality rate in childhood. So there are a lot of protection rituals around marriage, birth, conception, really was their way of, like Puri, trying to find some sort of control in a world that was often dominated by nature and therefore very cruel. And so they had all these elaborate rituals around weddings, for example. And DeMartino speaks of them. He says, the theme of binding as evil eye or envy recurs with regards to weddings and the consummation of a marriage in order to elude the evil forces threatening a couple. In Vigiano and Savoia, the wedding called Tej cannot follow the same road on the way to and from the church. In Colobraro and in Marisco Viteri, the bride and groom must jump over the threshold of the church, otherwise they may be attacked by a spell, and we saw that when the couple entered the church. In fact, on the threshold there may be a lace, knots, or other magical obstacles intentionally placed by some male or female specialist in spells. In Colobraro, the bride and groom must not dip their heads in the holy water font for fear that it may contain some dissolved, enchanted powder that has the effect of preventing consummation. During Mass, the couple's fortune is divined according to the gospel that is read only that of St. John is supposed to bring good luck to newlyweds, less so St. Mark and St. Matthew, while Luke creates a veritable panic among the audience. At the end of Mass, newlyweds and relatives often crowd around the priest who officiated and ask anxiously which gospel came out. But the riskiest moment magically is the most in need of protection, happens when the newlyweds are getting ready to consummate the marriage. In Grottole, the parents of the two newlyweds prepare the wedding bed, placing a rag under the pillow or on the night table that serves to prove the bride's virginity, which I love this one. This is just ridiculous. And some traditional instruments for fighting off evil eye, for example, 6 grains of wheat, a pinch of salt, open scissors and a sickle. And we've seen a number of these in the previous scenes here. Additionally, the bed must not have been seen, looked at by anyone except the parents again due to evil eye. And when the couple retires to the bedroom, two men, one for the bride and one for the groom, which we see here now, keep a vigil outside the door and prevent anyone from doing a magical conspiracy against the newlyweds to disturb their first night. And this consists in placing a plough or an animal's carcass outside the door. And there's nothing that says romance than having someone sat right outside the door, your whole family there observing, and an animal carcass. It's important to understand this, though, and she's got her own animal carcass there, a chicken. It's important to understand this, though, to realise that they're not just doing this for Puri's sake, although she has made public threats. This is something, this arduous ritualistic process is something that would have occurred anyway. This is a community that is shrouded in fear of this stuff, shrouded in the fear of evil forces if they don't maintain these rituals and practices to presumably keep them safe. Of course, as we are about to see, the only person who really needs to be kept safe is Puri. She is the one who is in real danger. And the film looks at sexual abuse and rape, given her status as vulnerable, and also how the fabric of this culture enables that, puts her at risk. And this, where she's looking for a sanctuary, already very disturbed, being attacked by this shepherd, although anything to do with rape occurs off camera. It's a powerful statement for a 1963 genre film made in Italy. And to bring this back to folk horror, it's here where the film seems to anticipate films like Michael Reeves' Witchfinder General, which takes a more historical, objective approach to the subject matter. It doesn't revel in superstition as the fantastique or as outright gothic horror. Instead, it looks at the horrific acts of those acting under the name of the church. And in that case, it's Witchfinder General Matthew Hopkins, played by Vincent Price. So Reeves' film also really exposes how these hierarchies were abused and women especially suffered under that hierarchy, and also the hypocrisy inherent in that. When Rondi released this film, there was a backlash towards it from some of the Italian film critics who felt that the film was anti-Catholic. But as writers like Roberto Curti have shown, and Curti was able to go into the records surrounding that, Rondi himself was a Catholic, as was Fellini, his longtime collaborator, and I want to look at that partnership a little bit further down the road in this track, because there is a parallel to some of the things that we find in Il Demonio to the stuff that Rondi helped write for Fellini. There's some sort of parallel. But this was a Catholic man being accused of being anti-Catholic. And so the film was considered quite outrageous domestically in a country that was still very much invested in the Catholic Church and the power of that church. It's not like Rondi is necessarily criticising the religion itself, though. I think he's taking a wider look and examining the power structures that are in place. And examining power structures seems to be something that he had a particular interest in. If you look at some of the script writing work he did, for example, the screenplay for Pasquale Festa Campanile's The Slave, aka Check to the Queen, which is a fascinating, remarkable film, semi-erotic drama about two women, both bourgeois women, but one, played by Heidi Politoff, decides to give up all agency and become the other woman's slave. It really is an essay on power and control within the confines of a sadomasochistic relationship. Really fascinating film. Rondi questions power even in things like Black Emmanuel, White Emmanuel, where you have the Emmanuel character in that, Laura Gemser, in a key role. Although her character's not actually named Emmanuel, it's Laura in that case, who is, and that one really is like a loose installment in that whole canon, because it was just named as the Emmanuel thing, I guess, to place it there with the connection to Laura Gemser. But in that one, you have the Emmanuel character who is in a very abusive situation with a photographer husband who puts her through some really horrible things. So there's a sensitivity there, I think, to how women are often oppressed in situations. In the case of Emmanuel, it's business. In this, it's within a community that is very, very invested in Catholicism and these hierarchies to do with the church, to do with men and women within this village. There was a real sensitivity there. And I think that is what Rondi was more interested in exploring rather than just having an outright attack on the church. But then if you look at the stuff that he wrote for Fellini, so The Temptation of Dr. Antonio, for example, which was Fellini's segment in Boccaccio 70, an anthology film, where you have a character who's very pious, very upright, and somebody sticks a big, very suggestive billboard with Anita Ekberg on it opposite his flat. And he feels like this is a corruptive influence. There's too much sex in society. Billboards like this that are blamed for the corruption of the young. And he launches this attack on it. And it's a semi-comic short that basically questions this guy's outright hypocrisy, because he eventually becomes obsessed with the Anita Ekberg icon on this billboard to the point where he starts to fantasize about her. So it's, in a way, again, kind of questioning this hypocrisy that surrounds the idea of women and sex within this very oppressive environment. Before moving on, because there's still plenty to say about this film, I wanted to come back to censorship for a minute. In the book Il Lungo Respiro di Brunello Rondi, which was published in 2010, which unfortunately hasn't had an English translation, but the title translates to The Long Breath of Brunello Rondi, and The Long Breath was one of Fellini's names for him. in one of the essays in that compendium, which really seeks to reinstate Rondi as something of an auteur and somebody who's been deeply misunderstood as a filmmaker. It's a fantastic book. But in the chapter I Colpi della Censura by Alessio Di Rocco, the author sets out some of the censorship that Rondi faced during his career, starting the chapter in stating Brunello Rondi was among the most censored directors of Italian cinema. This was Rondi's second film. The first one was a screen adaptation of Pier Paolo Pasolini's novel A Violent Life. And that one he had co-directed with Paolo Hirsch. So that one was subjected to a 4-meter cut in a scene that involved a police clearing of a demonstration. The ministry were really worried about the material and said it was insulting to the police. And after the film was released with a ban to anyone under 18 seeing it, there was a kind of a campaign against it, I guess. And a petition went to the Ministry of Entertainment, signed by a group of Catholic mothers who were calling the film unclean and immoral. Il Demonio went off to Venice after it was released and did get some sort of critical acclaim because of that. When Titanus were due to put the film forward to the Ministry of Entertainment, Mario Camerini, the director, actually wrote a letter to them defending the film because initially it was rejected by the commission on the grounds that scenes and sequences are detrimental to morality. So Mario Camerini had actually sent a telegram written stating that because Il Demonio was selected for the Venice Film Festival, it had a cultural and artistic value, therefore really reinstating the film as art, as a film that really had something to say. Despite this, Titanus, worried about the outcome, as listed by Di Rocco in this chapter, made quite a lot of cuts to it prior to it going forward to the board. So they expelled 43 meters of film, including what are described as the most gory details. And all of this has been reinstated now. But the cuts, or in the initial cuts, were the part when the shepherd tears off Puri's dress. That was cut. They cut scenes of Puri described as compressing her lower abdomen during the process of possession. Also the faces of her relatives during the exorcism and some of the shots of her doing the spider walk later on were cut. They cut out and Uncle Giuseppe putting his hand into her top after he put the card there. And they also cut her bare shoulder during the last love scene with Antonio Frank Wolf. And finally, the Bertolt Brecht quote was taken off the end. And this was a theme that then followed Rondi throughout his career as he went into, especially the 70s, into much more exploitation cinema. But always cinema that had something to say, that went a little bit deeper, especially in terms of the way that it looked at themes concerning power hierarchies. And some of his female protagonists were just sincerely fascinating and interesting. And in the same book that I've just referenced, there's actually a whole chapter on there that seeks to align Rondi with themes seen not only in the films of Fellini and Rossellini, who were two filmmakers that Rondi worked with early on in his career before he moved into directing, although his partnership with Fellini continued way beyond that, City of Women in 1980 being their last film they collaborate on together, with Rondi in the as part of Fellini's script team and one of his most trusted members and confidants. But in terms of the way that he often explored female characters specifically, aligning him with Ingmar Bergman and also Dreyer, and I mentioned Day of Wrath at the beginning of this track, and there's certainly parallels. Day of Wrath is another film set within the era of the Malleus Maleficarum, about a young woman who wants to follow her heart and is carved out as a witch and punished because of that. And there's definitely some sort of alignment there. And it's the same with Bergman. I mean, Bergman's treatment of women, especially when it came to sexuality and revealing those levels of guilt and shame and oppression, things to do with the female psyche, mental illness, there's, again, some sort of cosmic alignment there between Rondi and Bergman. And even in something like Bergman's The Virgin Spring, which came out 3 years before this, which is another film I'd argue is technically a folk horror, and it also was a big inspiration on the rape revenge genre and inspired Wes Craven for Last House on the Left. But in that, you've got the character of Ingeri, who is this outsider figure. She prays to the Norse gods and is pregnant but not married and is treated with suspicion in this Christian, overbearing Christian environment. And there's the scene with the card. I want to talk about this, actually, because we see yet again Puri is set up to be sexually abused and made vulnerable by her fragmented mental state. And instead of receiving the care and understanding that she really needs to recover support, we've seen that she's humiliated and she's cast out by the community. She is labelled a witch and then put in the hands of this uncle Giuseppe, someone who the community trusts. And we see this is deeply, deeply uncomfortable. In this way, I think this film really anticipates Lucio Fulci's Don't Torture a Duckling, which isn't a folk horror per se, but it is a giallo that is deeply, or I should say, takes a deeply cynical view of this kind of parochial, old rural Italian culture that is entrenched in Catholicism. And Fulci was another filmmaker who, again, a Catholic, but had a very complex relationship with religion. In that film, you have Florinda Balkan in the character of Machara, who is somebody who has been led to believe from a very young age she is a witch and has these evil powers which she tries to practice. But when you go further into the story, it turns out that she was sent to live with a guy who is, to all intents and purposes, a paedophile, even though Balkan's character is now grown up. She has grown up with this form of self-loathing and self-hatred, and this is awful. She's just raped. She goes there for salvation and is raped because of it. And what sort of message is that sending out to Puri? But I won't give a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen it, but Don't Torture a Duckling is a much more widely known film than Il Demonio. And many Italian cult fans have seen it. The punishment of Balkan's character and Barbara Boucher, actually, and Boucher worked with Rondi later on as well. But the character of Boucher as well is somebody who is judged by the local community for being a slut. She's somebody who's come in from town, been sent back to stay in the village because her father disapproves of how she lives her life in the city and that she's been promiscuous. So even though Fulci was as often come into the critical eye for being a misogynist, I would make the argument that actually, no, like Rondi, he exposed these hierarchies of power and he exposed how women suffered within that. And the character of Florinda Balkan in Don't Torture a Duckling is a deeply tragic character. And I would say that Puri is a foreshadowing or a forerunner for that character, in that she is treated in a very, very similar way. Although in Don't Torture a Duckling, Machara is just one of many characters, whereas this is all Puri's story. I think a lot of Il Demonio's power is that ultimately it explores the conception of female sexuality as a dangerous force, as a dangerous entity, something that needs to be suppressed, oppressed, and punished. Or actually, I should clarify that. I don't think Rondi believes that. What he's doing is exposing this belief in culture, in society, and also in Catholicism and superstition. That dichotomy of the virgin in the whore, which incidentally was a dichotomy that Federico Fellini was also interested in. And so you can see Rondi never took credit for the help that he gave on Fellini's scripts. And he's been described as a scriptwriter in the field, in that he would largely be on set. So set notes from 8.5 show that he was there advising, taking a much more collaborative part in the script building by being by Fellini's side, making suggestions, having a conversation, a dialogue with the director. But it was something that Fellini showed in a different way, because Fellini, again, a Catholic who had a very complex relationship with Catholicism, especially how Catholicism impacted on one's erotic life. I think Il Demonio is much more cynical than anything Fellini ever made, though. And Fellini could be very, very cynical in his films, although he often wrapped that cynical lineup in whimsical notions, in fantasy, and bittersweet comedy as well. He was also a cynical director when it came to Roman culture, the power of the church, and so on and so forth. So it really was like a meeting of minds between him and Rondi. But Il Demonio is much more provocative. It's nastier and much more outwardly cynical. It doesn't sugarcoat anything. And Fellini had a tendency to speak more between the lines in terms of his use of fantasy aspects, for example. He was also much more sensual in that way when it came to sex. His fascination with Catholicism and this type of dangerous sexuality came more from a position of childish wonderment, in that his own sense of sexuality was wrapped up in guilt and fascination and all these other things. Whereas Rondi seems to have a much more objective approach to the material, as an outside observer to sadistic practices, to oppression, to manipulation, domination. And again, these were themes that followed him throughout the body of his work in film. The main frustration for an English speaker with Rondi is that so few of his films are actually available. There's only a couple really that have had legitimate home video releases in the English speaking domain, which makes this restoration of Il Demonio just really important. But things like Black Emmanuel, White Emmanuel, for example, which Severin have previously released, his 1974 feature, Right in a Women's Prison, also had an American release. And then some of his other films are, you can encounter them, but it's very, very, very difficult to see them all. Le Tumani sul mio corpo, for example, which was the next film that Rondi did with Luciano Martino. Very, very interesting. Valerie Dentro e Fiori from 1972, starring Barbara Boucher. And I want to talk about that in a bit because there's some crossover between that. Run, Psycho, Run, the English title for Later, Claire, Later, from eventually released in 1968. That one was held up a little bit. And that was the film that Rondi did after Il Demonio. That one seems to have had showings on US TV at some point. And then there's also Ingrid Sulistrada from 1973, which is another film that follows on from the theme seen in Il Demonio, in that you have Janet Agron in that as this young girl, Ingrid, who's raped by her own father. She goes off to Rome to become a prostitute. Very sleazy, but it is all about these themes of oppression. And that one is super rare. It is frustrating because Rondi was such an interesting filmmaker, but I think because he has that marker of cheap exploitation in a lot of his later work, he's been completely ignored. Even though he had these close associations to people like Rossellini and also Fellini. But then in English-speaking scholarship around Fellini, and even in some of Fellini's own books, so I, Fellini, and Fellini on Fellini, given the fact that at one point Federico Fellini said in an interview that Rondi was one of his closest friends, he barely gets a mention. And I, Fellini's mentioned once in passing, in that he helped sculpt the party scene in La Dolce Vita because Rondi was very much part of that party circuit. So he's become this very obscure figure, even though even in Il Demonio we see that he anticipates a lot of which was to come, and he's also using this theme of witchcraft and superstition in a very untypical way compared to what we saw in the rest of Italian Gothic. This scene in particular, for people that have seen this film, the association to the later The Exorcist from 1973 is unmistakable. And we'll see Puri in a minute go into the spider walk. And of course, the spider walk in The Exorcist is the infamous thing. The irony in this is, in the wake of The Exorcist, Italy always been a nation to capitalize on what was happening in Hollywood, set about making their own cycle of exorcist themed films, and they're often called exorcist rip-offs, but they really didn't rip anything off because each and every one is much more perverse than The Exorcist. And here we go, we can see it here on celluloid. It exists, it is 10 years before The Exorcist this is happening. This comes from something else, which I'll mention in a minute. But this idea of the rip-off, the Italian ones were incredibly original and very different from Friedkin's film. And yet they were seen often as a nation of copyists, when the truth is Italy were often doing it before America in other ways. And this is just an incredible foreshadowing of Friedkin's film and the terrifying aspects of that. And of course, Dalia Lavi, who I haven't had a chance to really talk about, her experience, her training when she was younger as a dancer, really comes into play here. The physicality of this performance is astounding, absolutely astounding. And she's on record saying this was a favourite role. I'm not going to go into the biographical details of Dahlia Lavi, because for this Severin set, Tim Lucas has his own video essay talking about those aspects. But I do want to talk about Dahlia Lavi's position in Italian Gothic just for these two films, Il Demonio and then The Whip and the Body, which came out just after, and both of which were projects produced by the Martino brothers, Sergio and Luciano, both had roles on those films. In that entire, I guess, subgenre, these two films to me are like top notch. They are in the top five for pushing all the bars when it comes to talking about female sexuality, these more oppressive elements. And a lot of that comes down to Dahlia Lavi's performances in both films. As Puri, she contort, she is really put through the mill, she is abused, she spends a lot of time running around in bare feet, being pushed down, being manhandled, tied up, and obviously contorting her body also into the spider walk, into the more possessed aspects of this character. But also just the whole, her whole portrayal of a woman who is in the midst of a complete psychosis is incredible. It's absolutely incredible, an incredible performance. The Whip in the Body is similarly incredible, potent, and also a deeply subversive and transgressive film that has been so misunderstood. I think people often come to that, directed by Mario Bava, and they think, oh, it's about Christopher Lee, and Christopher Lee is in an S&M relationship with this woman, played by Dahlia Lavi, and it's the big man. It's the big man imposing his will on this little woman, and it's all about him. It's all about Christopher Lee. Whereas the film isn't about that, and I'm not going to give away the twist or any form of spoiler, but I will say, for a start, it was one of the first films that graphically explored S&M, like graphically explored it, and it was cut to shreds when it came out in the US. The theme had been explored in cinema before that, even right back to the pre-code era in films like 1933 Smarty with Joan Blondell, but that's more of a crazy comedy. But to specifically show S&M, that was like groundbreaking. But more than that, I think The Whip and the Body is a deeply subversive and transgressive film because it really is centered on a woman's sexuality. And it's a perverse, deviant sexuality. And I think that's where the misunderstanding comes from in Dahlia Lavi's character in that. And I think Il Demonio has been a misunderstood film as well. Those two films, her performance in those two films, they really are incredible films because of the performances. She was an absolutely beautiful actress, but she was a deeply powerful, expressive actress who proves in Il Demonio that she was really invested in her characters. And now, I said that the spider walk had like a sort of precedent, and I want to go on to discuss that now because this scene is very, very pertinent to this subject. One of Rondi's main influences for this film was the work of a director called Luigi Di Gianni. And Gianni was very, very prolific in making short documentaries, including, I mean, he made hundreds of documentaries, but one of his main fascinations, and he made quite a number of these documentaries, was on the Ernesto Di Martino sort of studies into the Italians' fascination with witchcraft, starting with Magia Lucana from 1958, which is a very expressive documentary told in this very moody black and white style with a very, very interesting soundscape, barely any dialogue, which explores the ritual superstitions of Lucana. You can see in scenes like this with the people gathering to basically cry at the weather, you know, why are you doing this to us? Is taken from Magia Lucana. And in the 60s, there seemed to be this cultural interest in these old world ways. I think another influence on the possession scenes in this, and again, it goes back to Ernesto Di Martino, who wrote a whole book, basically, on what they called La Taranta, which was a form of possession. And there was a short documentary by Gianfranco Mingozzi called Tarantula in 1962. And also Luigi Di Gianni covered possession, but this spider walks and everything really ties into that. Mingozzi would then direct the nunsploitation film Flavia the Heretic in 1974, and he used aspects of that tarantula possession in Flavia. But here, once again, you see it done much, much earlier, 11 years earlier. Although this isn't specifically the tarantula bite possession, it was this belief that they were bitten by a type of spider, and this would induce a mania. And if you see footage of these people, they're writhing around, they're dancing, and some anthropologists have seen this as like a form of mass psychosis. But a lot of writhing. Think Ken Russell's The Devils without the Jesus statue molestation, and it's that sort of thing. You see it in scenes of Flavia the Heretic as well. So once again, the work of Di Martino seems to have played into the aspects of possession in this, although it's separated from his work surrounding the notion of that, or the cause of that possession. Here, the possession is purely to do with his other work, this idea of binding, this idea that Puri has somehow, in some way, bound herself to this evil entity, and it's now causing her behaviour to change. I think one of the most standout features of Il Demonio is the way that it uses conceptions of the witch. And here, those conceptions of witchcraft are purely based in a superstition that largely remains unchallenged as superstition, and therefore an oppressive force, outside of that one scene where she sees the child by the river, which makes it slightly ambiguous as to whether she has visions or not. And we later find out that that child is dead. But for all intents and purposes, as I've already mentioned, this is following pretty much the same line as Witchfinder General. When we look at the witch within cinema, traditionally, those early conceptions, the hag, something to be feared, even though it wasn't a dominant icon in film, especially not in early horror film, early conceptions seem to, outside of things like Haxan, seem to float around this fairy tale notion, the hag type figure. And although this was challenged outside of genre by films like I Married a Witch, which was 1944, and also Bao Book and Candle, 1958, which were both romantic comedies, and also the popular series Bewitched, in terms of, I guess, the witch figure overall, when we did see it appear, it was linked largely to a kind of gothic tradition. Whereas Il Demonio takes a completely different route, and it uses that fear of the wild woman. And that fear of the wild woman, this comes back to the discussion of sexuality, is this pervasive thing that still exists today in different forms. And therefore, the word witch, for example, is used as a slur or an insult towards women. It's like, you're a witch, this means that you're somehow this dried up old hag. But it really stems from and the fact that witches, especially in the Malleus Maleficarum, were seen as dangerous because of their sexual potency and the fact that they were supposedly taking in orgies with the devil himself and therefore had this ability to seduce and corrupt. But that sexual angle of the witch didn't really occur in genre cinema until much later on. So Il Demonio really is like a forerunner in that. If you compare that to something like Black Sunday, for example, the witch burnt at the stake who curses everybody and comes back as this malevolent form, even though it's a very glamorous form because it's Barbara Steele, but this malevolence, this spite, this evil, this sense of, you know, almost sexual jealousy and all those things. Il Demonio is very, very different because it shows the wild woman really as a cultural stereotype that becomes a scapegoat. And it leads to all these really interesting discussions. But witchcraft was such a part of Italian culture. It appeared much more in their genre film than it did, say, in Britain or America. And in Britain, in particular, they didn't like in the sort of late 50s into the 60s, the BBFC did not like witchcraft. So if you see in Hammer Horror, they don't really start touching the subject till the end of the 60s. It doesn't become a thing, and then it never became a big thing anyway. So you tend to see much more occult ritual used in Italian genre film anyway. But quite often it's linked to this more glamorous form of sexuality. You also see it in Strega and Amore as well from 1966, which is more of a drama film based on Carlo Fuentes' novella Aura, but it is quite different to the Fuentes book directed by Damiano Damiani. That one takes the idea of the same idea of this obsession and the idea of the love spell, the love potion, but it makes it supernatural, and it stars Rosanna Schifano as this witch, very obsessive sexual witch, who's able to use witchcraft to ensnare people like Richard Johnson and a very young Gian Maria Volonté. And it's a wonderful film. But again, Il Demonio is there a few years before that. That said, I'd argue that Rondi's film doesn't really fit in with things like La Strega and Amore. It doesn't even really fit that much into the Italian Gothic canon overall. And in its position as a folk horror, I think it has far more in common with this group of films that were coming out of Eastern Europe throughout the 60s, especially in Czechoslovakia, through the Czech New Wave and beyond, that were using the concept of witchcraft to explore themes of persecution. Now, these films too, because of the way they are shot, because of their more brutal, savage elements, and the way that they draw on paganism and the brutality of rural landscapes, and the way they draw on these very, very oppressive insular communities, also sit alongside folk horror. And I'd argue that they belong in that canon to a certain extent. And the films I'm talking about are films like František Vlachil's Markéta Lazarová, set in medieval times around this young protagonist called Markéta, who, because her family can't afford for her to stay in the convent, she is cast out into this very, very brutal world. And you've got a character in that, a female character, who uses witchcraft as a form of personal empowerment. And there are a lot of themes around brutality and sexuality. And Markéta in that is really kidnapped, but then develops some form of weird Stockholm syndrome, and it is similarly cynical. It takes a similarly cynical line at the church, Christian tradition, and the treatment of women. And you've also got Vlachil's Valley of the Bees as well, which is more about a male protagonist, but you've got a female character in that who tries to find sexual freedom and is punished for it. Also Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev, which has a very distinctive scene in it where you have people within this village who use paganism as a form of liberation and rebellion. And also Witch Hammer, which actually appears on this Severin folk horror set, a very, very incredible subversive film from 1970. Again, Czechoslovakian, made after the Prague Spring. So made within a very, very oppressive communist environment that seemed to be using the Malleus Maleficarum and the witch trials to comment on the trials against cultural figures when the communist government took over in the post-war period. So it seems to be like an allegory, but it's a very powerful film, and it shows again the oppression and persecution of women under the Malleus Maleficarum, and is sadistic, deeply, deeply cynical, deeply disturbing, directed by Ottokar Vavra, who ironically wasn't a key figure in the Czech New Wave. In fact, he was part of the old school of Czech cinema that the Czech New Wave were responding against or trying to deconstruct that old Czech way with their new wave of cinema throughout the 60s, group of filmmakers that came out of the Prague school, FAMU. And Ottokar Vavra was seen as somebody who was very conservative, someone who had aligned himself with the state. And then he comes out and he makes Witch Hammer with Esther Krumbakova, who was a screenwriter and costume designer, who was a very subversive figure and got blacklisted in the post-Prague Spring era. But she also worked, for example, on things like Valerie and a Week of Wonders. And of course, Valerie and a Week of Wonders, which is much more of a fairy tale, that also has aspects of folk horror and this idea of awakening sexuality and the burning of witches and the punishment of women for blossoming into their sexuality and for wanting agency. And it's a very surreal film, but it talks about all these same things. And so I think if Il Demonio belongs anywhere, it's within that. You've also got a couple of earlier films that belong in the folk horror canon. You've got the Finnish film The Witch from 1952 by Roland Alf Hallström, which was based on a 1947 play by Mika Waltari. And in that, a witch is unearthed from the ground and she's like a femme fatale. She runs through this household, ensnaring all the men and causing mischief. And considering it was made in 1952, it's also got female nudity in it. You got alongside that another Finnish film, The White Reindeer, which was also 1952 by Erik Blomberg, where a woman uses again this sort of, and it's a pagan mythology. It's set around Shami shamanism, where this woman called Perita, she's lonely. Her husband is always away. And so she makes this pact and she becomes this vampiric reindeer who is able to ensnare men. And I think Il Demonio really follows on from those same sort of themes around the fear of the wild woman. The thing is, all these Czech films, and also to a certain extent the Finnish films that I've mentioned, none of those films come out of a formal Gothic tradition. They play much more with folklore. In the case of the films from Czechoslovakia, under communism, Czechoslovakia never really had a horror tradition. What you found instead was nightmarish fairy tale, more surreal films, or what Juraj Hertz called Strack films. And Juraj Hertz was the closest Czechoslovakia got to a horror director in that period. And he made things like The Cremator, Morgiana, a very horrific version of Beauty and the Beast. But this idea of Strack, which means fear, which was more centered on the cultural climate, on paranoia, suspicion, this suffocating claustrophobia, the demonization of people, this idea that you could get called out at any time. And that's certainly something that's present in films like Marketa Lazareva, this idea of suspicion and everyone being under surveillance. And you see that much more in those Eastern European films because there's no formal Gothic tradition. There's no commercial market for horror film. And so it's interesting that Il Demonio really aligns much more with those. And because of their fluid qualities, they sit much more easily in line with folk horror, given that folk horror is such a nebulous genre anyway. Whereas the more Italian Gothic films were much more of a formal thing produced predominantly for a existing commercial market that was alive and kicking in Western Europe and was really forged off the back of the success of the much earlier American Universal films. That's not to say Italian Gothic wasn't transgressive and subversive in its own right. The thing I've always loved about Italian Gothic was how female-centric it was. And it goes back to what Ingrid Pitt said, you know, the star of The Vampire Lovers, when she sort of changed the formula in playing a predator, in playing a vampire. She said, women in horror films only get remembered for playing predators. And up until things like The Vampire Lovers in British horror, it had predominantly been about male predators. And so The Vampire Lovers really changed that in a meaningful way. But the Italians were there doing it much earlier on. Their key star was Barbara Steele. And so a lot of their Italian Gothic films, especially because of the success of Black Sunday, revolved around femininity and these much more feminine themes. I think that's why you see more occult and more witchcraft crop up in those films, just as an organic thing, because they are much more female-centric. And that in and of itself, from a feminist perspective, the sort of evil of womanhood and all these challenging themes to the status quo is an empowering aspect in and of itself. But where it's largely focused on female monstrosity and the power of that, whereas Il Demonio looks at that monstrosity in a very different way, in a very different light. It looks at that monstrosity as something that is culturally created by this shared view, this shared superstition. I absolutely love this. I mean, it's not a subtle metaphor, but we've seen in a few earlier scenes, Puri eating apples. And of course, it goes back to Milton's Paradise Lost, the taking of the apple from the serpent. In recent years, a lot of feminist scholars have looked at Paradise Lost is more of a story of rebellion for women, in that Eve is granted liberation through that taking of the apple. And Per Faxneld wrote this amazing book on it called Satanic Feminism, where he looked at specifically around the fin de siècle how Satanism and feminism became entwined, because women could find a sense of power in aligning with occult forces, when within the Bible and within that tradition they were very oppressed. So it made sense that within occult communities women could take positions of power, for example. They could find some autonomy. And I've already touched on this, but it's one of the things I love about Puri's character and the way she strokes this tree, is there's a certain sense of defiance and rebellion in there. No matter how much she's crushed or pushed down or abused or persecuted, she remains defiant. And yes, she feels like she has this power of Satan within her. And it does lead ultimately to her destruction, because that's always going to be punished within society, especially when it's women. But she's also using that possession as a form of liberation. And she's going after what she wants. She wants Antonio. And she doesn't care what the community thinks. She doesn't care what they think of her. She's almost been given a carte blanche to do that because she can say, well, I'm possessed. And I think this really links back to what Per Faxneld said in Satanic Feminism. And so in some respects, Ildemonio could be cast as a satanic feminist film because it definitely deals with issues that now, in 2021, we would identify as feminist discourse. And obviously, I doubt this is what Rondi was openly framing this as in 1962, especially in Italy. But he certainly had a sensitivity towards women, I think, in some of his films, even though the treatment of them could be harsh. There was always between the lines this sensitivity towards them and the really the forces that worked against them. Like I've said, Black Emmanuel, White Emmanuel deals with it. You also see it in the incredible film that he did with Barbara Boucher, which again follows on, I think, from Ildemonio. In the Boucher in that film is, she's this young, sexually frustrated wife, and she can't have a child. She starts to suffer like a mental breakdown. She lapses into fantasy, for example. She finds it very, very difficult to distinguish from fantasy and reality. She becomes much more promiscuous as well. And this is a Valeria Dentro e Fiori from 1972, or Valerie on the Inside. And in the same way that Ildemonio uses psychosis attached to this sense of, I guess, sexual frustration, that film also uses that same line. And then you get this very patriarchal reaction from Boucher's husband, in that she's institutionalized and there's violence and brutality and also this awful air of domestic violence. It's a wonderful film, and again, a wonderful performance by Boucher. And Rondi seemed to be able to evoke this sort of very untamed performances from both Lavi and Boucher. It's an incredible thing. The way that possession is used in that respect is almost the same way that Andrzej Ziłowski would use possession in 1981's Possession, which is about, really not about possession, it's about a divorce, it's about all those awful emotions when you suffer rejection and when you have this unequal power dynamic in a relationship. And so Isabelle Arjani in that film, she falls into a form of psychosis. Although, again, that's one that uses aspects of fantasy, aspects of surrealism to explore these same themes. I need to completely change track now and talk about the Martino brothers, because this was Luciano Martino's first production credit. And Luciano, brother, older brother of director Sergio, really became one of the backbones of the Italian B industry throughout the 60s and the 70s. He was one of the first producers that was making giallo films after Mario Bava's The Whip and the Body in 1964. You then saw the early giallo films were very different to the Argento ones, especially the ones by Umberto Lenzi, which were much more like gothic melodramas, again, much more female-centric. And after the success of Orgasmo, Luciano Martino went on to produce Lenzi's So Sweet, So Perverse in 1969, and then thought, we should be making some of these films. Discovered Edward Fenech, who became his long-term partner for the next decade, and started to make giallo films with his brother Sergio directing, even though they'd made films before that with Sergio directing. But really forged themselves in the Italian cult industry with films like The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward and All the Colours of the Dark. The Martino brothers really came out of Italian film royalty. Their grandfather was Gennaro Righelli, who was a very esteemed film director who made the first Italian film with sound. And so their experiences as kids, especially being around their grandfather, and Sergio talks about this vividly in his autobiography, which is another book that sadly hasn't had an English translation yet, but he remembers being around the house and seeing all these key figures from the Italian film industry hanging around collaborating with his grandfather. Their grandmother, Maria Giacobini, had been an actress in the silent era. Their mother had acted, and so it seemed only natural that they would both go into the film business. And both took this similar route in that they started off, like Sergio started off ghost writing and reading scripts for Titanus, and Luciano also started in script work, and then he moved on to assistant directing, and then he moved on from that to producing, and eventually set up his own company, Dania Films, where he produced so many key cult films in the 70s, not just for his brother Sergio, but for also for people like Umberto Lenzi. I mean, Luciano Martino as a producer was like a force of nature. He was just so prolific and made so much in the domestic comedy as well. That was another big part of his empire, as well as moving on to eventually direct a few films of his own. And so here you get this beginning, these beginnings with Il Demonio and then The Whip and the Body. Sergio talks about this film with a special affection in his autobiography, because he just started dating his soon-to-become wife. And so he was down on this initially as a production manager, but he was quickly moved up to assistant director. And Sergio said that was at Rondi's request because he recognised something in him. He remembered when they had time off, he would go off and visit his wife. He'd get in his car and he'd visit his wife. And so he had very, very fond, really fond memories of the production. He thought Brunello Rondi was quite a character, because apparently to entertain the cast, Rondi was staging the seances in the evening, and he'd try and freak everybody out by moving the furniture. So Sergio said that when he came on to the set of this, it was actually the cinematographer Carlo Bellero, who I haven't even mentioned, but incredible, incredible cinematography on this, was so impressed with Sergio, he said, "You're going to be a director." And he said that always stood out to him, because 6 years later, he was a director. Interestingly, Sergio never set out to be that. He actually tried his hand at acting first and then script writing. And it was like more of this organic process with both brothers trying to find out where they fit in the industry. So Luciano was more of the businessman, so he settled into the role of producer quite early on. But Sergio sort of worked on all different levels, assistant directing, production management, until he finally settled into the role of being a director himself. And so this film is also kind of special because of that. And obviously I've written a whole book on Sergio Martino, so I'm kind of biased and I'm very obsessed with his work. But I don't think the Martinos get enough credit. If you look at the big names in production in Italy in that period, the 60s, 70s into the early 80s, you've got Carlo Ponti and you've got Dino De Laurentiis, were like the big cats. They were simultaneously working in Art House and B and like literally everything. But then you've got Luciano Martino, who was really producing. He did a little bit in the Western, but he came in a little bit too late for that. But really spearheaded productions within the giallo, within the Italian crime thriller, within the sex comedy. You know, this was a industry, a very tight, and with the Martinos, it was very family orientated. Like, they stuck with the people they worked with time and time again when they forged these associations. And so this really was the backbone of that industry. And these were people that were very dedicated to their craft and often working on very, very tight margins as well. So as we come into this last tragic scene, I had to mention the Martinos and their involvement in this, because quite often when you hear talk of the Martinos, it all really begins with The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward. And that was an important film for them, obviously, and it did really forge their reputation. And it was a time when the company was growing as well, and they had access to more money, they had more experience. But it starts much earlier on. It starts back in 1963 with Il Demonio. Into this final scene now, and it's Puri's last betrayal, and she really has been betrayed and let down by everybody around her, with Frank Wolf, of course, as Antonio. And I haven't mentioned Frank, bless him. He's incredible. He'd been working with Roger Corman and had moved to Italy in 1960. And again, he's so expressive in his scenes here. And it's such a complex and nuanced scene as well, because it's almost like this shared thing. Is he sleeping with her because he has this desire? Is he using the idea of possession to let himself off the hook? It's like, what is going on here? But it, you know how it's going to end. You know how it's going to end. And this is the part that was cut when he rips the top down. It's quite racy. Although when you consider, you know, the Italians were going into things like necrophilia with Dr. Hitchcock around this point. So compared to that, it's, you know, not actually that shocking, but it was considered impure, so it had to go. But all the way through this, I think Puri has been betrayed by everybody. She's been let down. She's become the scapegoat. She is considered dangerous for having her own mind, having her own sexuality, her own agency, her own desires, and not being quiet about that. And so she's rebellious. And in the end, she chooses to go to Antonio, even though it means her sacrifice, that she has to sacrifice her life for it. And so it becomes very tragic and heartbreaking, because in a way, everybody is a victim in Il Demonio. Even though people do horrible things, they're driven to do that because of this overriding fear that dominates every single aspect of their lives. It's an existence that is full of fear of the elements, and those elements are tainted with magic and evil intent. And so everybody is a victim of that. There's nothing good to have come out of this. Antonio ends up a murderer. Puri loses her life, and her family's lives will probably never be the same. And they've already been outcast and punished by the village as well. And that is the legacy of this, the legacy of those beliefs. And so when I said Il Demonio is very cynical in that respect, it is. To do with that work with Fellini, as we close down in the Long Breath book, one of the essays talks in there about, or quotes Rondi talking about Fellini's fascination with mythic religiosity. And some writers, including Curti, have made a link between Il Demonio and the miracle tree scene in La Dolce Vita, which is one of my favourite scenes in all of Fellini's work, where people are given this miracle and they tear it apart. So that in and of itself is very cynical, and it ties into this idea that Italy is full of magic, this ongoing thesis, this very Jungian thesis that Fellini had. Italy was so old that there's a shared consciousness and magic is everywhere, but that people didn't appreciate it. But Il Demonio shows you the other side of the coin. It shows you the danger in buying a little bit too much into that magic and what can happen because of that, how destructive that can be. And so it really is overall a folk horror film in that it warns the brutality inherent in that. And all that leaves me to say is thank you for listening.